Extra unemployment has officially run out. Millions face eviction and homelessness. Congress is not close to a deal. But hey, at least we're getting this TikTok thing figured out. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Oakland, I'm Molly Wood, in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Monday, the 3rd of August. Glad you could join us. I'm sorry to report it was more talk but no action again today in Washington as roughly 30 million people began to face their economic futures without an additional $600 a week in federal unemployment benefits. Until and unless Congress hammers out a deal for more pandemic relief, most jobless people will have to rely on state unemployment insurance. And as Marketplace's Kristen Schwab explains, when it comes to state benefits, geography just may be destiny.
If you're unemployed in Mississippi, your life could start to feel a lot different than if you were unemployed in Massachusetts. The maximum benefit in Mississippi is around $230 a week. In Massachusetts, it's over $800. And the gap isn't just about cost of living.
The big difference is the philosophy. Is unemployment something that supports the labor market, or is it a business cost to be minimized?
Chris O'Leary is with the Upjohn Institute for Employment Research. There is no federal standard for unemployment benefits, so states create their own rules around who qualifies, how much they get, and for how long. Michelle Evermore is with the National Employment Law Project.
You know, in some states like Florida and North Carolina, only about 10% of people who are unemployed are even able to get a benefit.
That impacts people's access to food and shelter. During a pandemic, it also dramatically increases their risk of getting sick.
Because of monetary concerns, they have to take an unsafe job. And that's going to actually spread the virus and slow the recovery even further.
She says Black and Latino workers may suffer most because states with the smallest benefits have the biggest minority populations. And Sylvia Allegretto, a labor economist at UC Berkeley, says differences in benefits can have direct effects on a state's economic health.
Unemployment benefits have a really important effect of propping up the greater economy.
While that extra $600 meant a lot to workers who lost their jobs, it also meant a lot to all the businesses relying on people who were spending it. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
Now to retail, where the apocalypse continues unabated. A couple more retailers declared bankruptcy over the weekend. Tailored Brands, which owns Men's Warehouse and Joseph A. Bank, and the department store chain Lord & Taylor. They join a list of COVID-era retail bankruptcies that already includes Neiman Marcus, J. Crew, Brooks Brothers, and the parent company of Ann Taylor and Loft. These companies all had problems before the virus, but now they're also up against widespread working from home, as in who needs a suit and pumps right now? Marketplace's Mariel Segura has more.
Amanda Rich is starting to feel bad for her shoes.
I'm actually sitting looking at them and I'm seeing like my leopard print ballet flats and this really cute pair of sandals that I bought last year, so I haven't really worn them.
She lives about 30 miles east of Seattle and works in communications.
I think they're thinking, you know, because they don't know, right? Did we do something wrong?
Rich used to wear business attire, a blazer or a dress with fancy shoes, to the office every day.
I have not put on a dress since March.
There are many lonely dresses and blazers and suits hanging expectantly in closets across America right now. And a lot of them came from retailers that have filed for bankruptcy during the pandemic. Many of those retailers started the lockdown with a lot of debt. Meanwhile, COVID accelerated a trend that was already underway. Tiffany Hogan is a retail analyst at Kantar.
We've seen the casualization of the office of workwear for several years now. Dress Down Friday is not just jeans anymore. It's even more casual than that.
Since working from home is the new normal until who knows when, could those retailers maybe change things up, start selling more casual clothing?
They're two totally different animals.
Michael Londrigan teaches at the Fashion Business College, LIM.
You know, you can't just flip a switch and say, I'm going from formal wear to casual wear.
A retailer would have to buy different materials, find new suppliers and designers.
And that takes time.
Which we seem to have a lot of. Google, for instance, has told its workers they're not going back to the office until at least July 2021. I'm Mariel Segura for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, some more activity seemingly completely divorced from reality. Details when we do the numbers. On my regular show, Marketplace Tech, we've been looking at the technology that could help us transition to a post-pandemic future. More now on the importance of connectivity, starting with education. Distance learning requires a functioning device, digital literacy, and of course, a robust internet connection. But a recent report from Common Sense Media and Boston Consulting Group found that millions of students in the U.S. lack either a device or internet access, or both. And hundreds of thousands of K-12 teachers also lack hardware or internet access. Elizabeth Gadelman-Galicia is Vice President for Policy at Common Sense Media.
Thanks for having me.
So let's just start with the basics and talk about what you found in this report. How many kids did you find had trouble accessing distance learning?
So we're talking about 15 to 16 million students nationwide. And this is students that either don't have an adequate device, students that don't have adequate high-speed connectivity, or both. And we heard from students and we heard from teachers about trying to navigate learning. For example, there was a student who was trying to download a 4-minute algebra video, and it took over half an hour. Or we heard from teachers who weren't able to upload videos that they had made or host a Zoom class, so had to drive to a parking lot where they could access free Wi-Fi. So speed, it needs to be adequate connectivity where it's high-speed broadband. So if you have connectivity, you need, what else do you need? You need a device. Now, try to do a book report or, you know, navigate a chemistry lesson on your phone. Mm-hmm. Mobile only is not going to cut it either when it comes to distance learning.
How much would it cost to try to close this divide, given all those factors?
Yeah, there's always the, I mean, it will take an investment. It's a range, $6 billion to $11 billion to get students ready to learn. Now, the high end accounts for, you know, census data right now shows that there's, you know, average of 2 kids per household, and recommendation is to have a 1-to-1 ratio of student to device. So you would allow for a device for each student. You would have an environment where you could be participating in interactive online learning throughout the day. And then at the high end, it would allow for the kind of learning environment that I frankly think teachers are really hoping for if they want students to succeed, you know, when it comes to distance learning.
Where might that money, I mean, does that need to be federal investment?
This would be something, and this is an ask out to Congress, and this is talking about putting in funding that would allow schools immediately to purchase hotspots for families, to get devices in the hands of families and get reimbursed. It's interesting. We have precedent in the past for when it comes to educating our children, we make sure that they're ready to learn. So if you think about free and reduced price lunch, why not have something like free and reduced price access? And think about having vouchers for students that need devices and broadband so they can be learning.
Are there conversations or investments or innovations that you see happening now that do give you hope that you think could potentially get us to a more equitable future?
Yeah. I mean, I'm trying not to be cynical.
We all are. That's why I'm asking you help. Help us.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's encouraging, first of all, we're co-sponsoring a bill in California, Broadband for All. It has less opposition than you would anticipate. There's a parallel effort in California to close the digital divide that has industry involved, and we've seen tech companies step up with providing devices to students. We see a lot of low-cost and free broadband opportunities. Now, those usually, you know, those are time bound. You know, we want to see what are sustainable solutions. So I think if industry can continue to lead the way by, you know, showing where they're willing to step up, you know, that really sends a message to policymakers that they need to make the kind of investments to make sure that, you know, this is sustainable and we're really addressing student and family need.
Elizabeth Gadelman-Galicia is Vice President for Policy at Common Sense Media. Thanks so much for the time.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Marketplace is doing a new 3-part series called The Economy, What Now? Marketplace Tech produced The Pivot Point, about how tech is driving our post-pandemic future in health, the workplace, and education. You can hear that this week on select local public media stations or listen at marketplace.org. With skyrocketing unemployment, workers everywhere are struggling to pay rent. 43 million Americans are at risk for eviction right now. And this story is playing out around the world. For the latest in our series, My Economy, we hear from a landlord who opted to give his tenants a four-month holiday from paying their rents. From our partners at the BBC, this one comes to us from central Kenya.
My name is Mike Munene from the Republic of Kenya. And I'm a landlord for more than 10 years. I have about 29 to 35 tenants. I deal with people of low income, people who struggle in life. At the present, they have been laid off because of the impact of the coronavirus on the Kenyan economy. So I called for a meeting and I told them from now henceforth, they will be using the money that is meant to pay for the rent. They use it to care for their families. When I called for the meeting, even though they know me well, they were expecting bad news. They thought I wanted to increase the rent or tell them, if you are unable to pay for the rent, to vacate and look for somewhere else. So when I told them that they will not pay for rent for 4 months, some started and getting a bit confused because they could not understand that reality. And then they started shedding tears of happiness mixed with sadness. They got shocked. The financial loss has a lot of impact on me because it's around $3,000 per month. But I found that this is the opportunity to help those in need, because there was a time I was a tenant. So I know how it feels to be a tenant and how they struggle to pay for the rent. So what one has in the bank is not important, but what you are doing to support your fellow human being at this moment. This is the hour of need.
Michael Munene in central Kenya, courtesy of the BBC. We needed that, right? Tell us what's going on in your economy at marketplace.org. Coming up,
the initial response was, oh my God, this is a disaster.
I mean, who hasn't had that thought lately? But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 236 points, 0.8% to close at 26,664. The NASDAQ rose 157 points, 1.4% to finish at 10,902. I believe that may have been a record at some point. And the S&P 500 was up 23.7% to end at 3,294. Leading those technology stocks, Microsoft, which gained 5.6% after confirming it is in talks about acquiring the U.S. operations of social media app TikTok, which is currently Chinese-owned. More on that in just a moment. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 0.55%, and you're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Molly Wood. The popular Chinese-owned social media platform TikTok is increasingly the avatar for our Cold War with China, which is mostly being fought economically. So a few days ago, President Trump announced he was considering banning TikTok over security concerns. Then Microsoft announced it might be interested in buying. Trump reportedly objected. And then just this afternoon, Trump gave Microsoft the green light, but also said the U.S. government should get a cut of the sale. In case you're wondering, yes, all of this is extremely not normal. But as Marketplace's Jasmine Garst reports, TikTok is a really big deal.
TikTok is a wildly popular social media platform where users upload snappy videos like this one.
Wow, you can really dance.
That's a TikTok video of singer J-Lo dancing. It's been viewed almost 2 million times. In the U.S. alone, TikTok says it has over 100 million users. Ari Lightman is a professor of digital media at Carnegie Mellon University.
During the pandemic, the numbers associated with people flocking to TikTok and utilizing the app have just grown exponentially. I mean, we haven't seen this kind of growth since Facebook.
In the tech world, Microsoft is seen as the serious company that does grown-up stuff like office software, Skype, and LinkedIn, which is why when eMarketer analyst Deborah Aho Williamson heard it wanted to purchase TikTok,
I was like, what? Microsoft and TikTok? You know, Facebook maybe would be a better fit, but because there are so many antitrust concerns, it's not really possible for a company like Facebook to acquire it.
But now, with the administration's blessing, Microsoft can. TikTok could place Microsoft in the big social media leagues with the likes of Facebook and YouTube. What's with President Trump's change of heart? Cornell professor George Allen Hay says banning TikTok would have been a bad move.
Some young people are actually voters, and they really enjoy TikTok. And the idea that they can't see it because he's banned it would not resonate well with them as voters.
Microsoft has said it expects to continue discussions until September 15th. Plenty of time to upload your latest dance videos. I'm Jasmine Garst for Marketplace.
Here's the thing with this pandemic. It, and more precisely its global economic impact, are unlike anything we have seen in modern times, and no one really knows what might happen in the next months or even years. And all of that is creating a real challenge for the people on the front lines of the economic war against the virus. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore has more on that.
This economy is being pulled, torn even, in different directions. Prices are rising in some areas, for example, and falling in others.
You've got some parts of the economy where the main story is a shortage of supply.
David Wilcox is a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute and former head of the Federal Reserve Domestic Economics Division. Food prices, for example, are up 5% from a year ago, in part because supply is down or disrupted.
We've all seen the stories about meat processing plants and so forth, or in other cases, it might be snarled supply lines from other countries.
But in a lot of the economy, the issue is too little demand. People aren't buying.
A lot of families are just really on the financial brink.
They're spending less, especially on things like energy and transportation, where inflation is slowing down the most. But this whole situation has some people, like Marcus Brunermeyer, anxious. He's a professor at Princeton.
Right now, it's a fairly unstable situation because we live in a world of high uncertainty.
He says there's a danger of what he calls an inflation whipsaw, where the country lunges from low inflation to high inflation.
We are not spending now much because everybody's very scared. But once things ease up, we say, okay, now we catch up and we spend again and the demand is kicking in. And that might lead to inflationary pressures. So that's a danger which might come down the road.
That means that on the other side of this crisis, the Fed will have to be extremely careful how it guides the economy.
It just means if you make a small error, it will have much bigger implication.
But that is a problem for a little down the road. For now, the Fed isn't worrying about inflation. It's throwing everything it has at the economy to just keep people employed. Ann Owen is professor of economics at Hamilton College and a former Fed economist.
I think the Fed's biggest problem is that they're running out of tools, and what they really need is fiscal policy to help them do their job.
In other words, she says, the Fed needs Congress and the White House to hurry up and come up with some more coronavirus relief because there is only so much that the central bank can do. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
In listing the business sectors whose futures are up in the air, we cannot leave out restaurants, many of which have gone out of business altogether, and many which are trying to adapt with total different business models. The owners of one high-end restaurant in Berkeley, California, have actually opened a new restaurant in Oakland during the pandemic as a takeout operation. Sarah Husseini from KQED reports.
Have a great one.
Thank you.
Here in Oakland's Grand Lake neighborhood, masked employees shuttle brown bagged orders from the kitchen to several rows of holding racks. These are destined for pickup customers waiting outside and a stream of double parked delivery drivers. The restaurant Komal next door is heading into its first Friday night. Co-owner John Paluska is upbeat, but that wasn't the case just a few months ago when the Bay Area began its coronavirus related shutdown.
When this whole thing hit, we were just about ready to open as a regular old restaurant. And I felt the initial response was, oh my God, this is a disaster.
Paluska already owned two side-by-side restaurants in Berkeley. One was a more upscale dine-in restaurant, Komal, that offered plates for 2 to 3 people to share for up to $56. And adjacent, a more casual cantina that offered takeout. And those takeout offerings, $11 burritos, bowls, and tacos, and a few dine-in favorites, started flying out the door. In fact, the cantina, also called Komal Next Door, recently had its best day ever.
So we're actually over 100% of our historical high water marks.
Paluska's using the same approach for the new restaurant in Oakland and can't see changing it anytime soon, even once indoor eating is allowed. Now, refrigerators and shelving racks have taken over the original Komal's former dining rooms.
And we're having enough success with this where we feel like we just want to ride this out until we're on the other side of the pandemic. And I think it's going to be a long time.
And as the pandemic continues, he wants to protect the health of his staff. After having laid off all of his employees early on, he's been able to hire about half back, thanks to a PPP loan.
People say pickup is the new dine-in.
That's California Restaurant Association President Jot Condi. He says Komal Next Door is an example of how the pandemic is reshaping the industry.
Where you have talented chefs creating what used to be food served on a white tablecloth, putting out quality food in a sort of grab-and-go type of setting, and are meeting the demand of the customers as they're evolving.
Condi estimates that about a third of California eateries won't survive the pandemic. He predicts the overall restaurant failure rate will be even worse, up to 50% in urban areas that rely on tourists, like San Francisco. So the city is looking at other models for the future. Jay Chang is with San Francisco's Chamber of Commerce.
We have an economic recovery playbook that we built in the chamber, and commissary kitchens, like shared kitchens, and helping restaurants pivot to takeout and delivery is like our top priority. It's like what we think is the future of the restaurant industry. It has to be.
Chang says restaurants that can shift their operations won't necessarily be raking in the cash, as takeout margins can be thin, but they might just be able to survive. Back in Oakland, longtime Komal customer Dave Collins is picking up his takeout order from the newest spinoff restaurant.
Got a veggie bowl and a carnitas bowl, and we're going to share it, and a giant cocktail.
You heard that right, a giant cocktail to go. In Oakland, I'm Sarah Husseini for Marketplace.
The This final note on the way out, I want to give you a few more numbers about the looming potential eviction crisis. You heard me say earlier that up to 43 million Americans are at risk of eviction. Nonprofit Quarterly compiled some other numbers, like how 26.5% of U.S. families are reporting housing insecurity, according to the Census Bureau. A conservative estimate suggests that more than 2 million people could end up homeless, and that's assuming only 23 million people get evicted. And of course, the pandemic has reduced capacity in shelters because of social distancing requirements. The White House said today it's considering unilateral action to stop evictions, since Congress appears nowhere near a deal. And now for a quick moment of economic context on Microsoft and TikTok. Microsoft's biggest acquisition ever was LinkedIn, $26.2 billion in 2016. The last time Microsoft bought something cool was in 2014, $2.5 billion for Minecraft. Our daily production team includes Andy Corbin, Ali Pham, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Bennett Purser. I'm Molly Wood. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.